Welcome to Popcorn Psychology, the podcast where we watch blockbuster movies and psychoanalyze them. My name is Brittany Brownfield, and I'm joined by...
Ben Stover, individual therapist.
Hannah Espinoza-Rimas, marriage and family therapist.
And I'm a child therapist. We are all licensed clinical professional counselors, also known as therapists, who practice out of the Arden Counseling Center in Chicago. Even though we are licensed mental health professionals, this podcast is purely for entertainment purposes and to fulfill our love of dissecting pop culture in all forms. And today is the first of our Halloween episodes, yes, which I'm pretty psyched about. We're talking about Sixth Sense. Ooh, that's hard to say.
Yeah, it is.
And so I think people are pretty familiar with Sixth Sense. I think we've all watched it before.
Yep. I think the last time I saw it was probably in 1999. But yes.
It's the first time I've ever seen it. I never watched it. Shit.
Okay.
Yep.
And I've seen it a bunch. And so I'm assuming most people know what it is, but basically the general plot is... It's about a 10-year-old boy, 10-ish. He might be small for his age.
Yeah, somewhere between 8 and 10, like I think.
Dead people, and he kind of gets help from Bruce Willis's character, who's a child therapist, who we find out, spoiler alert, is a ghost.
I think, you know, after the movie came out in 99, we're probably good revealing spoilers.
Yeah. I also think that was a movie where everybody knew the twist, like, 1 week after it came out of
the theaters. Yeah, like I knew the twist and I've never seen the movie and I knew the twist.
I'm just going to point it out that my friends who are listening to this as well as me who are fans of Robot Chicken are not going to be able to hear you guys keep saying twist without thinking of what a twist!
That something on Robot Chicken?
Yeah, they have M. Night Shyamalan. They did like a whole episode and he's like a recurring thing. They'll have him come up and be like, what a twist!
That is definitely a hole that he dug himself into pretty hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty hard.
Yeah.
So, we're going to kind of break it up into, one, talking about Bruce Willis's character and kind of our perception of how he did as a child therapist, how he, like, conducted himself in the movie as a child therapist and what we liked and what we didn't quite agree with. And then we're going to also talk about Haley Joel Osment's character, Cole, and his presentation and how accurate that was within the movie. And then we're going to talk about kind of... what it's like to work with, like, psychotic clients. Because even though in the movie, in the world of the movie, what he's seeing is genuine. He's genuinely seeing ghosts. It isn't dissimilar from what it's like working with a psychotic client. Or, well, I should say a client who has psychosis symptoms. Person first, language.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because when we are working with a client who is living with those types of diagnoses, despite that, we can, from the outside, assess that that is... not something that's real that they're encountering. It's real for them.
Yes. Because I think a good... Well, not to jump into it, but, I mean, a good part of this movie is when he says to Bruce Willis's character... I'm just going to call him Bruce Willis because I don't remember what his name is.
That's fine.
So when he says to Bruce, how can you believe... how can you help me if you don't believe me? And I think that's a real question.
I think I've been asked questions very close to that.
Yeah, I've definitely been asked questions.
And I think
like that
what we'll kind of.
Who are experiencing psychotic symptoms.
For sure. And what we can touch upon later in more depth is you don't have to believe in their psychosis, like believe that also see the things they're seeing and like believe that part of it. But you can definitely believe the reality of what they're experiencing and how traumatic that is for them.
Right. That despite that you can't. Empathize with it, you don't see it, you don't feel it, that it is real and feels real and scary for them.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine how you would feel if there was a man in black that was always outside your house and always watching you, and that would be really terrifying. I had a client who experienced that for sure, and I definitely found early on in my career it was a very important part of rapport building to establish with the client, like, I believe that you see that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's either a satisfying answer or an extremely unsatisfying answer, depending on the client.
And also, I think, depending on where they are at the time, you know, whether or not they're closer to being in crisis mode or not, them being able to understand that. I know that the way that I would say it is, I believe that you're having that experience, and that sounds really scary or very frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine how hard it would be to do things hearing voices all the time.
Mm-hmm. So, we kind of jumped ahead a little bit, but
yeah.
With our first topic, which is Bruce Willis in this movie,
mm-hmm.
I really don't remember his name in this movie, besides Bruce Willis. Is Bruce Willis always Bruce Willis?
I got
though?
Nothing, man.
He's either Bruce Willis or he's John McClane, one or the other.
He either has hair or he doesn't. So,
so I would say, what are your guys' opinions on how he was in this movie as a child therapist?
I thought in general, as a child therapist, that he did a excellent job.
I was so pleased with him. Like, this is, I've seen this movie a bunch because I love scary movies and I just love this movie. But watching it as a child therapist, I was so pleasantly surprised consistently through the entire movie with how he conducts himself with this child.
Me too. It was very accurate and authentic. He was very gentle, very patient, mm-hmm. very client focused. He used self-disclosure well. He used games and he used moments where he would defer to the client's authority very, very well. And all of those things are things that are necessary to do when you're dealing with a child and especially with a difficult client who doesn't want to engage. I thought he did mm-hmm. an outstanding job at that.
I'm going to therapy explain you a little bit. So when you say client focus and when you say let him drive the situation.
Right.
In particular, I think examples in it were like he always came into session. Well, I wouldn't say session. He kind of came into his interactions with Cole, letting him kind of take the lead in terms of he never forced him to talk about a topic. He always let him kind of go where he wanted to go with it and didn't push. Like if Cole was being really quiet, he didn't force him to talk. He would right. either like try to change the subject or kind of just go. If he said something really random, he would just start talking about what other random thing Cole brought up. And also, I think the most thing he does, which is very empowering, is when he literally says, what goals do you want to work on while we're together? Which is such an accurate, actual therapist thing to say, especially. But I don't think that happens often enough when working with child clients.
No, not at all.
Too making
much
them
control.
Part of the process. Because I think in my experience as a child therapist, I don't want to generalize, but I've had a lot of experiences with, well, I've had several experiences with parents where I think it makes them nervous if I get too therapeutic in my language with the kid in terms of like, well, this is what your diagnosis is and this is a treatment plan. And I think the parents can be really anxious about me making it too obvious that the kid's in therapy and that something might be quote unquote wrong with them and like giving them too much kind of a look behind the curtain. Mm-hmm. But I see it as kind of almost treating the kid appropriately like an adult. Like, you have power. Like, I'm talking to you. Like, I respect your opinion about this. And I think you can handle hearing it.
Yeah. And I think that's a vital, like, component of working with kids effectively is you have to show them that despite the fact that you're going to work with their parent and talk with their parent and incorporate their parent's needs into it, that the session is theirs. Unless it's a family session, the session is between you and the child. The child is your client, and they need to know that they have the same rights and responsibilities as any other client does in a session, and you want them to have buy-in and to feel like they have agency and control over where their treatment is going to go.
Mm-hmm. And that you're not just going to come in and say, oh, so your parents told me that you did this and this and this.
Or we have to talk about this because
it's
a problem.
We have to talk about this because this is what you've been doing. Versus coming in and saying, you know, how was your week? Or whatever mm-hmm. it is that the kid is comfortable talking with. And how Bruce Willis does an amazing job building rapport with mm-hmm.
I think I built that. I mean, I think I wrote that like 8 times in my notes. Yeah, like, great same. Job building rapport. Such a good job at building rapport. Oh, my God. He's so good at this. Like, I would say a good counterexample is when they, like, the second time they talk, when he's in his house, mm-hmm. Bruce Willis is in his house, and they do, like, the mind reading game, and mm-hmm. they talk about the picture he drew and how it was scary, and how Cole said, yeah, they had a meeting about it, and so now I only draw rainbows and happy things. Because that's what happens when you go into it with an agenda with a resistant kid. Or resistant client, period. Is the kid's not picking up, like, oh, this is something bad, and we should work on it, and I want to... And you're coming at helping me. They're saying, oh, this was a problem. And this caused a lot of meetings and stress. And I don't want to have meetings and stress. So instead of working on the core issue, I'm going to fix the symptom, which is scary drawings. That's not going to happen anymore. Exactly. So if like you come at a kid with like, and we need to talk about you saying that you have suicidal thoughts, because that's a problem. The kid will just, the kid won't stop having suicidal thoughts. They'll just be like, well, then I'm not going to talk about that anymore to anybody, and it'll just become a secret.
Right, yeah. And they'll stop telling you. And I thought, something I wrote down when I was talking about, or watching the movie, is when he started talking about that drawing scene, is that if you take away someone's expression, their art away from them, and it becomes just a moment where it's turned against the kid, like, the kid's going to stop having that as an outlet.
Well, it's also to catastrophize it, too.
Well, right.
Like, to make it such a big deal. Like, especially now with what kids are exposed to. Who knows what the fuck he was drawing?
Well, and then something else with that is that, like, if this kid is truly having a difficult time, like, having their artwork be authentic is a good window into that. Mm-hmm. And that becoming something that gets taken away from them can be removing a coping skill, and it removes trust from the situation, because then the kid is no longer wanting to trust that they can express themselves authentically, and mm-hmm. that is going to create yet another barrier and possibly resentment in between the relationship of the child and the caregiver or whoever's trying to be the helper in that situation.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that what you were talking about before, Brittany, about how being very transparent as you can with the child. So that is a situation where nobody really talked to him, and they're just like, this is a problem, and he had to decide for himself how to fix it and what he could do to make sure it didn't happen anymore. Instead of somebody saying, hey, like, if that would have gone, if he could have done that process with Bruce Willis, how different that would have been for him.
Because it's also letting the child lead.
Exactly.
A way that you do that in sessions sometimes is by asking what we call open-ended questions, which is, instead of being like, hey, what's this drawing about, what's going on, like, instead of being very directive about it,
yeah,
you could just be like, hey, I found this drawing, can you tell me about it?
Yeah.
And then who knows, because we all, I think sometimes we jump to conclusions, and sometimes a kid can draw something like that and it can look very scary on paper, but then you ask them a question and they'll be like, oh yeah, like, I saw this in a movie, so I just drew it because it came into my mind, or my friend told me to draw this, or it could be,
it doesn't have to be anything thing. It could have just been that it was just something that he was just drawing,
or maybe it was a nightmare he had, and that's okay too.
Right My brother was a good example of this. Like, he has had a lifelong obsession with horror movies. He just has. He's a big horror movie fan, and when he was younger, when he was in school, he's 7 years younger than us, and we would play a lot of Doom and other, like, first-person mm-hmm. shooter video games, or we'd watch movies, and, like, and he would draw pictures from Doom, which was a definitely violent zombie-killing game, and had a lot of violent imagery to it, with, like, things getting blown up by rockets and, like, their blood and guts and melting and all kinds of stuff, and he would draw pictures of this because he liked to play Doom, too, and his brothers liked Doom, and then his teachers would freak out, like, this kid's going to murder everybody. I'm like, nah, I don't, that's not the case here. He just likes he likes horror movies. That's it.
And it's okay to be concerned about something that your kid is, you know, demonstrating, drawing. But you can, there's a thousand better ways to go about asking. It's like being inquisitive instead of making, like, just jumping to conclusions and, like, creating a panic around it. Because even if you don't necessarily, like, tell the kid exactly how you're feeling about what you've discovered about them, they can feel the room. And everyone is, like, shoulders hunched, freaking out.
Yeah.
The kid's going to, I mean, also in a situation where, I don't know if he was in the school meeting, where you have a kid sitting at a table and they're surrounded by, like, four adults looking at him like, what the fuck? Like, that isn't creating an atmosphere. And when, one, where a kid feels like they're going to be heard. And two, where a kid feels safe to talk. And three, where they feel like, that's a situation where it feels like you have to have the correct answer. And he found the correct answer, which is now I draw happy things. And like I said, it just creates more, this is what I can't tell people. And it kind of goes forward into when Bruce asks him about his mom, and he says, well, I don't tell her things like that because she doesn't look at me like a freak. So now you're creating a narrative for this child that certain things make you different and make you wrong. And when people know that about you, it changes how they think of you. So you better lock it up.
Yeah.
And how likely they're going to be to communicate with you.
Yeah. So going back to Bruce, he does such a good job of, he never comes at it he never asks leading questions, and he never comes at it with, like, an agenda in mind.
Right.
Which I think is so important. Because I think, and I get why that can be frustrating, because a lot of times kids are coming to us because there's a very specific problem that Absolutely. The parents have a concern about. And I totally understand that. And so there can be frustration of, well, why aren't you asking them about this? Or why aren't you talking about this yet? You've had four sessions. Why aren't you discussing the thing?
Yeah.
And a lot of times the answer is because the kid hasn't brought it up. And unless it's, I'm worried that they're going to hurt themselves or someone else, there's no reason for me to bring it up. Unless it's that very specific endangering situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely wish that parents understood that if you want me to effectively be able to help your child, mm-hmm. I have to have a relationship with them. And that's mm-hmm. not going to happen mm-hmm. in two sessions where all I do is come in and ask drill them questions the and drill them about what happened at home this week. Like,
well, I mean, this movie is a really good, crazy as it is, a really good example of the progression of appropriately building rapport with a child.
Oh, yeah.
Because he gets Absolutely. Steadily more comfortable and open mm-hmm. with Bruce as the movie goes on. And he doesn't tell Bruce his secret, the secret.
No.
Until, what, like 45 minutes into the movie? Maybe longer? Maybe an hour?
Like an hour.
Yeah.
Hour, yeah. And
hour
so,
and 10, maybe even.
And and that's okay. And yeah. he wouldn't have ever been able to tell him the secret and tell it in a way where they could work on it until he was ready with a capital R.
Yeah.
And so, and you could argue, if you were looking, you know, you could argue looking at their relationship up to that point, that every time Bruce talks to him, they don't get anywhere because he just plays games or he does magic tricks or he does the mind reading thing or he's just silly and tells him jokes and things like that. But all that, without that part of it, the building rapport part of it, you cannot have effective therapy with a child. Period.
No.
Or with anyone. I think that it's an important thing that sometimes people come into therapy, either they're bringing their child in, they're bringing their family in, or they're coming in themselves like, hey, I got a problem, fix it. But mm-hmm. One of the things that I think needs to be stressed to people is that in the field of counseling and psychology, there's a lot of press and there's a lot of people pressing for evidence-based practices. Show me what works. Do a controlled thing over and over. But the research overwhelmingly over and over shows that independent of interventions, assuming you are equally competent in interventions, the consistent thing that proves to be the vehicle to healing is the therapeutic relationship. Mm-hmm. And you can't have that relationship without building rapport.
Well, basically what it is you're coming into a room with a stranger and you're supposed to tell them all the deepest, darker secrets that you have and trust them to not wig out on you. And you're not going to, you don't know how a person's going to be with what you tell them until you get to know them better, especially a child who doesn't really understand what's happening some of the time. You know, seeing a therapist, what does that mean to them? They're usually not there because they want to be there or chose to be there.
Right.
And with like Cole, for example, I mean, this secret is a scary secret in that it could get you locked up, quote unquote.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
So he had
for an adult,
to the hospital, for sure. Yeah.
So what he learned up to that point by just kicking it with Bruce's character is if I tell him this secret, he's not going to freak out on me.
Yep.
Because that's really what that whole beginning part was, is learning how he was feeling out how Bruce's character is.
Yep.
And part of that's testing him by being shut down some days. Like, I don't feel like talking to you today, and seeing how he reacts, you know, being very quiet some days, being jokey some days. Like, he is kind of a little bit different with him every time they meet. And all that is Bruce proving to him that no matter how you react or no matter how you are behaving that day, I'm still going to be calm. I'm still going to be positive. I can be silly. I don't need you to tell me everything right now. Like, I can wait for you.
Yeah.
And I think that is honestly the most important component about being a child therapist or a therapist period, but especially a child therapist, and about having quote-unquote successful interactions with your client.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I think you're absolutely right, and I think that in this movie Bruce Willis did such a great job of showing patience and unconditional positive regard. He was so Rogerian in this movie, which is so Carl Rogers was the pioneer of person-centered therapy, which a lot of people kind of stigmatize therapists with as a therapist that goes and doesn't say a whole lot. It makes the client kind of direct, does the therapy. But a lot of what it is showing the client that regardless of what they've done or who they are. You believe that they were doing the best that they could during the situation, that they can learn from it, they can move from it, that they are a good person, and no matter what, you're going to show them that you believe in them, period. Regardless of what they've done, who they've been. So you show them that you're going to always believe the best about them and that they have the best possible future ahead.
Well, no, you're not going to wig out. And I think that's the biggest component, because the reason, why don't we tell people what we think are the bad things about us? Because we think they're going to freak out on us. They're going to change how they feel about us, and they're not going to handle it well.
Right.
And so, I mean, so when you're just calm all the time, you're showing him no matter what you say, like, I'm going to be here. Mm-hmm. And he does that beautifully. Italian chef kiss. Beautiful. When he finally tells him his secret, he doesn't freak out. He doesn't even look concerned. It's so beautiful and exactly the right thing to do, which is no matter what the kid tells you, no matter how scary or fucked you think it is in your head as the therapist, you keep a still face, you keep a calm disposition, and you just keep talking. Or you keep letting them talk. You know, you just stay like this, no matter what the child says. And he does that beautifully. Like,
he does.
He just, because he says, I see dead people, which is fucking crazy. And he's just like, okay, well, tell me about that. Or what's that like for you? Or even saying, like, that must be really scary.
Yeah. Anything, any kind of validation in almost always is something that really helps with building rapport, because it's helping people understand that these are scary feelings that you're having, and it's okay that you have them.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's okay for that to be difficult, and it's okay for that to be weird and scary and frightening for you. And let's talk about it. I thought he did a great job of staying calm, like you two are saying, but also like then exploring it from a standpoint of, okay, so this is real. So, you know, like tell me about like what's going on for you. And how...
What does that look like? How does that feel?
Right, what do they
say? It's the parameters of the situation. Because even though it looks like you're maybe buying into what the kid's saying, what you're really doing from a therapist standpoint is assessing the situation. Mm-hmm. How real is this for this kid? What's actually happening?
Right.
Are they feeling like it's touching them? Is it just visual? Is it auditory? Like, you're gathering all that intel, but you don't have to ask, like, very medical... their like psychological questions to get those answers if you're doing your job well.
Yeah, and I also think that part of asking, trying to explore when somebody tells you something like that in session, is that trying to explore it with them, I think, also lets them know that you're not going to forget about it and that you're glad that you told them. A lot of times after, I had a client who once slipped in something fairly serious right at the end of the session, and then when I asked her to say it a little bit louder, she didn't want to say it any louder. And then so I just let it go, and then the next session I was like, hey, so we're going to talk about that a little bit, because I did remember, and it's okay.
She's probably testing you out.
Exactly. Like, and it's okay, but it's also that same thing I feel like with anyone, where just letting them say it and then maybe not having a response can also be kind of hard. And being able to explore with any kind of exploratory question, I think, helps them relax and know that it's okay, and that I'm here to help. And I just want to know more about it, or what can I do to help you?
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it's like, and I said, it's like a way of getting questions, like getting your questions answered as the therapist, because you do want to assess the situation. When you get told something like that, that's really intense, ethically, you have to get to the bottom of it. But it doesn't have to turn into a third degree interrogation to get those answers. You can do it very, like you said, Ben, Rogerian-like, which is, tell me about that. Oh, what's that like for you? You don't have to wig out.
No.
I think.
And it won't help if you do.
Yeah.
Like, and they'll also shut making, down and tell you stories about rainbows.
And they won't come back.
No, they will not.
Because also, if you're wigging out and the kid's sensing that, then you're making the session about you now and about your reaction
to the kid. And you're asking the kid to take care of you.
Because I would say,
and your reaction.
His mom also does this really well, which is when he tells her at the end the scary, like his big secret, she cries because it's an emotional story that's personal to her. But she doesn't freak out on him either. And all the other times too, like when he acts, quote unquote, acts out, or like something's going on, she does not, one, hold a grudge, which is beautiful. Two, she stays very calm with him. Even when it's a very scary situation, she doesn't really understand what's going on.
Yeah.
She doesn't let him really see how much it's freaking her out. which is also Italian chef kiss. Beautiful. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the mom did great. So something else I wanted to make sure we hit on is the de-escalation that we see in this movie. And we're kind of like transitioning into it because the mom did a great job. And with that, like when he was upset, like she'd talk to him. She, even though she wanted him to tell her what was going on, she would even still just, please tell me. Like she was clearly upset, but didn't escalate. But what really caught my attention when we're talking about de-escalation was, I can't remember this guy's name either, so we're just going to call him
Gray. The guy in the beginning?
Yeah. So Donnie Wahlberg? Donnie Wahlberg. Yeah. Bruce did an outstanding job of using de-escalation techniques.
He doesn't yell. He doesn't raise his voice.
He sat down. He was apologetic. He was exploring the situation. When you're dealing with a person that is that irrational and that upset, that is the best approach that you can possibly use. Unfortunately, it didn't work out for Bruce in that situation.
I mean, the unfortunate part is it's a continuing the stereotype that people with mental health issues are dangerous and violent and can hurt you. Yeah. I mean,
correct.
That's the only like nitpick I really have about that. But I think in kind of explaining more what you're talking about in de-escalation, what we kind of learn to do more organically, but if I want to break it down, like when you sit down, when someone's agitated and they're and you guys are both standing, especially if you're the same height, if you sit down like he did, I'm using hand gestures as if you guys can see me, as if this isn't an audio-based situation. and you sit down, it makes the person feel less intimidated. Also, he does not go closer to him physically. He keeps the distance. Maybe even makes more distance.
I think he makes more distance.
He makes it so that the guy can see him.
Yeah.
So he's doing a lot of things to make a Vincent Gray, the distressed person, feel like he is still in control of the situation.
Yes.
By sitting down, by keeping distance, by talking to him calmly. And it's all really good. Like, it's all really well, like, what you would do, what would any, like, well-minded therapist or mental health worker would do in that situation.
Absolutely.
Like, he doesn't yell at him. He doesn't try to intimidate him. He doesn't try to get close to him. He doesn't try to, like, alpha dog him or, like, use his, like, physical prowess to go after him.
No.
To show force, I guess, is what I'm talking about. Which I think people, a lot of people, that would be their natural inclination because you want to freak them out, make them leave. But, and in more, and more situations than not, it would have been successful. Percentage-wise.
Oh,
in this
yeah.
situation, it was very, it was very personal. Vincent probably came into that house already making up his mind what he was going to do.
Oh,
and there's probably nothing that Bruce could have done to talk him out of it. Because from his situation, it sounds like he was someone who has been in agony for years. And so this is probably like a building plot in his head.
Well, I think, it definitely seemed as though it's a narrative that he's been telling himself.
Like he had a plan.
There was no way that he wasn't going to end the story that he's been telling himself for years and years and years.
Right, but like the chance that Bruce had to make that a peaceful ending, which unfortunately was not, but in the reality of situations like that, sometimes the only thing you can do is to work on de-escalation. Like, had Bruce charged him, he probably would have killed him and his wife, both.
Yeah.
Or would have just gotten out of hand. It would have gotten out of hand really quickly.
Yeah.
Right.
And it would have just proved that person's point, too, which is you're an unsafe person and I need to take care of you.
Yeah. Right. Right. Which within the story wouldn't have allowed for the narrative to build. But like when you're looking at actual people who are distressed, the techniques that he was using of staying calm, sitting down, allowing that person to feel powerful, allowing that person to speak their mind, not defending himself.
Yeah, that's
apologizing.
True. Yeah. Yes.
Because all of those things are important to do. When a person is distressed, you have to take a minute to de-escalate them. You have to take a second. If you just listen to them, it takes the fire out of the situation.
Absolutely.
You can take the fuel away from the fire by going, I hear you. I'm willing to listen to you. Because chances are, when they're that upset, they feel like no one has heard them, that they have to do this in order to be understood. They have to do this in order to get attention, to be noticed. And if you can take the fuel out of that fire, you can oftentimes de-escalate people. I have worked in residential where I've seen it go both ways, where sometimes, like in this movie, regardless of what you do, that person has made up their mind.
Yeah.
But I've also seen other times where that person thought they had their mind made up, and you are able to go like, hold on, use your relationship, use gentleness, compassion, and care to allow something to de-escalate.
And well, in this situation too, even though we know, because we saw the whole scene, like he had a plan, he had intent, he brought a weapon, like he had a plan.
Yeah.
But maybe the situation would have been he just wanted to be heard.
Yeah.
And he wanted Bruce Willis to understand what he did to him.
The impact.
And how he felt. Yeah. And by handling, if that was what the purpose was, that probably could have de-escalated that really easily. And then when he would probably stay with him, make sure he stays calm, and hopefully his wife would be able to like skedoodle somewhere and like call the authorities. But I mean, that's what it would ideally have looked like.
Yeah.
But it's tricky. Because they needed him to shoot him.
I was going to say.
Because he had to be a ghost.
Yeah, I was going to say. It also felt like it was just a part of the story and that mm-hmm. it was going to be in the movie always anyway.
Well, right. Well, and he also had to discover that he made a misdiagnosis. Because that's where he
Vincent
had
Vincent was the learning experience.
Right. Vincent was the because he had to know that he made a diagnosis. Because Vincent had the same issue as Cole, we realized. Like, mm-hmm. And what his like complaint was like, you ruined my life by giving me this misdiagnosis and like not helping me. And
that is like my worst fear, dude. Like as a child therapist, like it does make my heart hurt seeing that, you know, adult like child, you know, and not feeling like he was helped accurately. I mean, because we're dealing in a extraordinary situation where like it is ghosts, genuine ghosts.
Right.
But to feel like that you're so quickly diagnosed. I mean, that is where the tricky part of kids, like you don't want them to just kind of be shuffled into a label and then that's that. They're not a person anymore.
Well, because we never know, especially with kids, there's a really good chance that they're going to end up in mental health treatment in another way. And so you don't want to have them have something that then they carry around their whole life. And that's what I think, at least that's
like
the way.
Like poison them to the idea of therapy and stuff?
Yeah. Well, not only that, but just having this diagnosis that they won't ever be able to shake off because it will be in paperwork at the public school that they go to and mm-hmm. how it's just, but it's also really tricky because it's just so hard. And when kids are little and they don't, it's hard to find the symptoms and hard to be able to diagnose them accurately in some ways based on the information you can get and whether or not the parents are willing to work with you and how much information mm-hmm. you can gather.
Right. So as we are clearly moving into like the diagnosis section, let's take
I want to say one more thing he does that's really good. Just because I want to nitpick it a little bit. I think one thing he does really well that I think I've watched other people get really anal retentive with children about, child clients, is that there's a lot of the scenes Cole isn't sitting on a chair and he isn't looking at him.
He's hiding behind the couch.
It's not a big deal. He just keeps talking to him because I think sometimes we get hung up on making sure the kid's respecting the situation and listen, respecting you as the adult. And I've watched a lot of other mental health professionals, parents, yada yada, teachers get really stuck in what we call power struggles with these kids because, well, they need to be looking at you. Until they're looking at you, we can't go on. Right. Or you need to sit on the chair, or you need to be here, you need to be there, you need to be listening. And then it becomes about this stupid little behavior and we're not even talking to the kid about what they might be distressing them.
Exactly.
And so I think I really respected, and I didn't notice this all the other times I've watched this movie, is how rarely, until they're more comfortable with each other, or Cole's more comfortable with him, does he look at him? Does he, even sitting down, he's like walking around sometimes. And it's never, Bruce never says, hey, I want you to sit down. Hey, I want you to look at me. And sometimes that can be appropriate with the kid if they're being really avoidant or like, Or you want them to really make sure they're listening to you because you want to make a emotional point with them, which I think his mom does really well because she does the, hey, look at me, look at my face.
Yeah.
That's a time when that is appropriate because you want the kid to feel what you're saying.
Yes.
If it feels appropriate. But I think he does a really good job of not getting hung up on, like, I guess, rules or manners because people go crazy. Like, I've seen people just get so stuck on that with kid clients.
Oh, yeah.
That you don't move on. You spend a whole fucking half hour bitching about the fact that the kid's not looking at you.
That doesn't mean anything.
Because also, when a kid's uncomfortable with you, to expect them, also to expect a kid to act like a tiny adult is infuriating.
Yeah.
And two, a lot of the reason why he's probably walking around is he wasn't comfortable yet and he was trying to make himself comfortable. So let the kid have what they need in the moment to make themselves feel more comfortable. Because sometimes kids, sometimes adults I work with don't want to look at you.
Yeah.
And that doesn't have to mean anything.
Right.
Right.
And to get stuck on that is neither here nor there, and it can just make everything pointless.
I remember when I was doing kind of a internship at an elementary school, and one of the things that they pointed out, and they said, make sure that you're like whatever side of the room, that you're on the same side of the room as the kid. So like there was just never a chance where I would have to be sitting across from them. It would make them feel more comfortable. And a lot of times the kids weirdly looked at me, and that was fine, because it wasn't about that. It was about helping a child feel comfortable with an adult, comfortable enough to be able to tell you things, and how much more important that is. Because a lot of times, the other thought that I have whenever we talk about kids being in therapy is that there's also a good chance that this is their first or second experience, and that there may be a chance that they will have to see a therapist later on down the line as well.
So don't make it this like adult is up in your ass.
Yeah. So if you don't want to push away, you know, an 8-year-old kid who's coming in, because there's a chance that you might not be the only therapist that they see, and really helping them understand how important it is to help them understand the therapeutic relationship.
And also there's a big difference between a kid walking around your room picking up stuff but still talking to you, and a kid who's walking around your room playing with everything in your office and not paying attention at all.
Yeah.
And that would be a situation where I'd be like, hey, can you put that down? Come over here, sit next to me, like sit across from me, let's talk. But sometimes kids need to be kind of preoccupied because they're anxious, because they're uncomfortable. And as long as they're still kind of engaging with you and it feels okay, like just let it fucking happen.
Yeah, and I thought that was done really well with this movie. And he did a good job of even proposing things, ignoring behaviors that were irrelevant to his goals, which is like, that's an important part of kid therapy. Like
because kids will test you just to see if you'll get stuck in a power struggle with them.
Absolutely. Right.
Like, can I rein this adult into some bullshit?
Yep.
And then if you ignore it, they're like, oh, okay.
Right. So I guess not. Yeah. Then that loses that appeal. I also guess I wanted to highlight on like rapport building with him is that he did two things that sometimes people view negatively in therapy, but in my opinion, they're not right, is that he used swearing.
Wrong.
He swore with the kid. Because that's bullshit. Like, that sounds like bullshit. And the kid was, like, kind of stunned. But when he did that, he used it strategically. It wasn't just, like, him callously forgetting that he was working with a kid. He used that strategically to break the kid's defense.
It adds gravitas to the situation that I feel like the kid probably really appreciated. Like, when you swear like that very pointedly with a child, what you're telling him is that I'm taking this seriously, what you're telling me, and I think it's bullshit, too.
Yeah. Yep.
And, I mean, it's a lot different than just saying, fuck this, fuck that. Like, because if you use it sparingly like that, then you're kind of almost like letting the kid be on your level as an adult. Like, this is the weight of an adult issue.
And also, kids swear.
Yep.
Kids fucking swear. Like, I was swearing when I was, like, in second grade. Like, kids swear. It's not something, again, your example of I think it's really important to be really specific about it and make sure that it carries the weight that you're hoping for, and not just coming in with fucking F-bombs like I curse all the time. Yeah.
I was just saying, I don't think any of us who have listened to this podcast are surprised to learn that you've been swearing since the second grade.
Yeah, well, and also, if a kid swears in your office, don't get hung up on that either.
Exactly.
I mean, if it becomes like excessively disrespectful, I mean, the difference between them calling you a bitch and then saying like, she was such a bitch, and you're like, okay, well, what made her? And it's so, and sometimes I'll repeat the word back if the kid says it like, oh, what made her such a bitch? You know, and but I'm not like validating like him calling this person a bitch,
right?
But like, it does add a weight to it that I feel like the kid will, because sometimes kids really feel respected, or they really feel like you're viewing them, you're giving them adult level seriousness,
which
in that moment
that's important, is that you're allowing them to go like, oh, okay, hold on, like this is a different type of relationship. I'm not dealing with my parent here. I'm dealing with somebody that's on my side, kind of talking to me more on my level, and is joining with me and is allowing me to be the authentic me, and I don't have to put on a show. And I think that that's important. The other thing that I thought that he did really well was, at least once, the second time I thought it was too far, but he did, when he was in the hospital with him, after he told the big secret, he was telling a bedtime story, the bedtime story routine right before he told him the big secret. Bruce used his story. He told the story of how him and his wife weren't doing so well after he had, you know, an incident with the client. So he used self-disclosure in order to build trust, but the way he did it was not making it about himself. When he was trying to terminate with the client, and he started, like, making it about how, like, I can't help you, I need to help my family, I'm doing this, like, I thought that was making it too much about him and not as much about the client. But when he was telling the story in the hospital, I thought he did a great job about using his own story and self-disclosure strategically. So
self-disclosure sounds like what it is, which is when you use personal information when you tell a client something personal about yourself. And it can be a real gray area in therapy, because you really want to use it with, you really want to be thinking it through why you're choosing to use it with a client. Are you using self-disclosure because you want to make it about yourself, which is no. If that's the answer in your head, then mm-hmm. if the answer is yes, then don't do it. Mm-hmm. But if you're using it to make the kid feel connected to you or the client in an appropriate way, like absolutely. Not so you can be like fucking buddies. Right. But I think in this situation, what he did so beautifully, like you said, Ben, is he made it into a bedtime story and he used third person.
Right.
And he didn't say, I'm having problems with it. He said, there's a man. And he said, and the kid knows what he's talking about.
Right.
But it created a boundary with the storytelling, kind of created a wall up there. Like, we're not necessarily talking. We're talking about me. It's kind of like the I have a friend.
Yeah.
Say, I have this friend. Yeah. It creates a kind of a wall there where everyone's kind of respecting what's happening. But choosing to tell the story like that. Like, when you say I have a friend, the person is going, what, you? They're like, okay, I understand implicitly by you saying it like that, that that's something you don't want to get into too much, and you want there to be space between this conversation. And so I think that was a really beautiful way. And I do agree, when he ended treatment, quote, I mean, it's weird saying it like this because it's not structured.
Yeah.
Like therapy.
Right.
Relationship. But it should never be because of personal problems that you're telling a person why you're no longer seeing them. Like, but I guess that kind of rolls into, not to keep going with the first topic, but the things that are not really realistic in this movie about the relationship, like him having sessions, quote unquote sessions, with him in the environment all the time.
Yeah.
Like when he first meets him in the church and he's like, you missed our session today, so I showed up at the church. Well, you would never track down a client because they missed a session to go have the session in the wild.
Unless you're doing some kind of very specific outreach with clients who are needing that. But generally with kids, you're not going to see that happen.
Especially with kids.
Especially with kids, because
you're not
going to
track them down. Yeah, no.
Because then their parents will have a lot of feelings about that.
Yeah.
And they should.
And they should.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I know it's very...
It's hard because
it's hard
part
in
of the
this
story.
Movie because it's part of the story is because he's dead. And so he doesn't have an office to, like, see this kid in. And so it has to be in the environment. But you would never see a kid client unless it was, like, very specifically connected to what they're working on. Like, a good example would be when he goes to that play.
Yeah.
That might be a time to go, if it was important to them, like if it's something they were going through, if it was a goal that you had together in treatment that they were going to do this play, and then they, as support, they asked you to go. But that would also be something you would talk to their parent about.
Absolutely.
Make sure the parent was cool with. Or like when he goes with Bruce to the funeral.
Yeah.
To hand... Which is technically part of their treatment, because they're trying to figure out how to deal with seeing the ghosts.
Right.
So the goal is, let's try to help them. This is the task, try to help them. So it's a very measured goal.
Yeah.
And so that would make sense for your therapist maybe to support you in that, because you might have a freak out during the experience. You might need coping during it. You know? Like you kind of do with an obsessional, like someone with like obsessive compulsive disorder, if you're going to do something in
like
the
exposure
wild,
therapy,
you would be with
is
them
what
with
it's
that.
Called.
But it would involve a lot of coordination with the parents.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of probably paperwork that's signed just to make sure everything's on the up and up.
Absolutely.
And a lot of, and it would be very, I guess my thing is, in this movie, it's very loosey goosey. And my concern is that he almost takes on a parental dad-like role with this kid.
Yeah.
Like going to the hospital and sitting next to his bed when he's falling asleep.
Yeah.
Like being in his home, going to this play, walking around with him, it would, just especially with a kid that doesn't have a dad, that has a single parent, like it would make me a little weary about becoming too involved in the kid's life, and then he would be really distressed when I left, like as if he was losing a parent.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think for me, there were two things that stuck out as not necessarily realistic. One was done by Bruce, and the other was done by the doctor, which was the director, which was, and both are sort of revolving on the same topic of like potential abuse or self-injury of the client when he goes to the hospital. So early on in the movie, Bruce Willis sees that he has scratches on his wrist, and he's like, I think he's talking to his wife about it even, which is also generally not done. But he was
a lot of HIPAA violations.
But he, if you saw a kid and you suspected that there was possible defensive wounds, or which he's a word he uses.
Scratches on your back, which you can't give yourself.
Well, he didn't see that. It was scratches. It was his wrist.
Oh, yeah, okay.
He didn't know if the kid was self-injuring, and he never once asked about it. And, like, that's a, you know, therapy intake question number one. Particularly if you have a kid who, you know, you might be suspecting of that, you're going to have to assess for that immediately to see what's going on. Like, what's the danger? What did you, how did you get that? How did that happen? Like, because he goes through the rationalizations, which it could be possible of, like, did this kid... Is this just a kid that plays outside and likes to climb trees? Or yeah, is this a kid right. that you know, is being kids get abused?
Bruised up.
Well, like, is naturally. He a little bit clumsy or is it something that's going on?
Right. And he would ask about that. And the other thing I thought was not realistic was the doctor was having this conversation about potential abuse and you're going to have to talk to the social worker with the mother in the waiting room. Like,
oh, not having it in an office?
Not having
oh,
it in an office.
Point. I didn't even think about that.
Not in a private space. If you want to talk about a good way to trigger violence, accuse somebody of doing something that can get them in trouble in front of an audience. That's
yeah.
a almost guaranteed way to trigger a crisis.
Because people are going to act defensively.
Correct.
But it is accurate that if she took him to the hospital, she would have to talk to a social worker. Like, that is pretty standard.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. But I just think, which we've already kind of pointed out, that all of those ways in which he's doing sessions out in the open, like, that's, you can't really do that unless it's, again, a part of a really specific plan that you have.
But also, you have to be careful about privacy and confidentiality that's you're having sessions like out in the open.
Yeah, to make sure that you're following HIPAA guidelines, so.
And him going into the school and stuff, it seemed like he was doing a lot of things that maybe the parent would have been doing instead.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's where it gets kind of tricky because you want to continue to build up the parent-child, as we say, alliance, their relationship. And absolutely. You don't want to make sure that you're becoming like a parent proxy.
Right.
Because you're not supposed to be in the kid's life forever. Their parent will be. So you want to always be making sure that the parent is the primary person building things up with the kid and doing little touchstone things with the kid.
Yeah, because the goal is for the child to be able to transfer some of what they're learning with you to their parent.
Which they do. Because yeah. at the end of the movie, he tells his mom. Yeah. And he lets her become that person for him.
Exactly.
Yep, he definitely does. The treatment is terminated and they go through a realistic way of going about that with a kid. And then the kid translates that relationship and the growth onto a more positive, trusting relationship with his mother. Was there anything else we wanted to cover with...
No, I mean, it was done. It makes me wonder how they knew to do this so well.
Like, I remember you asking that when we were watching the movie. Who also wrote it,
like, has he been in therapy? Does he know child therapists? Like, sorry, I have allergies. But does he... It's so specifically... it's just done so well in such little ways that real therapists do things like using magic and games. And it's just, it's hard to imagine someone just figure that out outside of the bubble of a mental health professionalism.
Yeah.
Because it's so well done. It makes me wonder if he consulted with the child therapist.
Yeah, I would imagine that they definitely had one. There's too many things that I don't think people would know.
Mm-hmm. Too many little nuanced things that are like so right.
Okay, so... let's move into diagnosis here. So with this case, we see Bruce do some diagnosing right away. And then we see him kind of moving through a rule out process after that hospital scene where he starts, like, he never shows the kid or that he's believing anything different about him, but then he goes and starts talking to his recorder. So you see in his notes that he has the same diagnosis, like, rule out for that kid that he did for Vincent.
I wrote possible mood disorder,
right?
Acute anxiety and socially isolated, which that's at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
And that, I mean, is a good diagnosis because I like that it says possible mood disorder because with a kid, especially that young, you really need to figure out what's going on before you just slap like a definitive mood diagnosis, like a bipolar or depression.
Yeah.
Because with a kid, everything is like, well, and in this case too, like it was his environment that was causing him distress, not a chemical imbalance in his brain. Because when you give someone a depression or bipolar diagnosis, for the most part, it's because there's a chemical imbalance in their brain. It's genetic. And so you want to make sure that there's a big difference between that and like something's happening in their life that's making them moody, irritable, mood swings, stuff like that. And so I thought that was very good. And then later he says possible schizophrenia after he tells him he sees dead people. And that's also very accurate. It is. Just further proving the point that I assume M. Night Shyamalan talked to somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When he was creating this movie.
I would assume so. But with the way he was going through the process, what I really liked about it and thought was accurate was, as you're kind of hinting at, Brittany, is that he was not quick to start slapping labels on this kid.
Mm-hmm.
He was like going to,
and even with the schizophrenia, he was like possible schizophrenia based on maybe hallucinations.
Right.
Everything was very like couched, like maybe.
Right. And something to cover with that is that when you're talking about having psychosis, schizophrenia isn't the only option for that. People can have depression that gets severe enough that when they're very depressed, they can have psychosis. With bipolar disorder, you can have psychosis. With post-traumatic stress, you can have psychosis. All of these things can trigger. And with bipolar, it can be either you're so manic that you're not in touch with reality, or you're so depressed. So it can be either way. There's also subsets of schizophrenia, such as like a mood disorder combined with schizophrenia, which would make for schizoaffective disorder.
It can be, basically, it's really complicated, and when you diagnose someone, you have to be really mindful and look at our diagnostic manual really hard and make sure you know exactly what you're talking about.
And generally, before you get a diagnosis like that, you're going to have gone through some testing, and it would generally need to come through either a battery of tests from a psychologist or a psychiatrist. A counselor should not be giving you a diagnosis of schizophrenia.
Yeah, like what, I don't know exactly what Bruce's credentials are.
He's a psychologist.
Yeah.
So he would refer him to a psychiatrist to get a real evaluation.
Or do testing.
Or because he's a psychologist.
He could do testing, yeah. He could do testing.
And I guess but I just want to, when we say psychosis, we mean like, because I know people say psychopath a lot and stuff like that. Psychosis, when we say psychosis or psychotic, it means like seeing things that aren't there, hearing things that aren't there, having like fantastical ideas, like everyone's out to get me, I'm the queen of France, like,
yeah,
I'm not living in reality. Right. It's very paranoia, different than being like a psychopath, which is like the movie version of like being really evil and crazy and like blah, 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 like maniacal.
Yeah.
That's very, very different than having psychosis. Someone can be a very calm, loving, chill person and have psychosis.
Absolutely. And we could find that this psychosis, where it becomes like a differential diagnosis, which is what the professional term for what Bruce is doing, is, does the psychosis happen independently of the mood? And that's where you would be looking at a more chronic diagnosis of something like schizophrenia, where it's the psychoses are chronic, independent of mood, they're omnipresent.
And by independent, you mean like happening at a different time than the mood stuff is happening.
Right, right. Whereas like if someone is dealing with severe depression with psychotic features, that would mean that when they're very depressed, they can get so depressed that they start hallucinating or having paranoid thoughts, mm-hmm. or getting catatonic, which means that they either move very slowly or don't move at all and might hold weird positions.
Yeah.
These are all things that could happen. But as far as like the way he went about this diagnosis, I thought that he was very accurate, very measured, and realistic to how someone would be cautious with a kid, especially because you wouldn't give schizophrenia generally to a 9-year-old.
Yeah.
Well, I think what to keep in mind, like you said, with working with a child who's saying things like that, is this a genuine psychosis, or is this a fantasy that they've created to help them deal with whatever's going on with them?
Because
kids have fantasies and they play and they use their imagination to cope with stuff. So, or they have, maybe they're in an environment where they have an ill parent, where the parents telling them things that aren't true, like religious fanaticism, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and so maybe they're culturally, like they're living in a family where they believe in ghosts.
Right.
And so then you have to pay attention to that. So there's a big difference between someone who's genuinely like having, because like I said, with the chemical stuff, like when you're schizophrenic or psychotic, you have something in your brain is not working correctly. It's like, it's an organic genetic issue.
Yeah.
Correct.
And that's very different than, and that's why you need to be on medication a lot of the time, because you need to treat that thing in your brain that's not working correctly. Mm-hmm. But, which I love, because then he doesn't, and he shows this by not saying this kid needs to be on meds right away in this movie. Like, he feels it out because he's trying to figure out what the parameters are. Like, is this something he really sees?
Yeah.
Or is this something that he's using as a way to deal with his life? Or is this, maybe he's just kind of immature for his age and still believes in things like, you know, believing in Santa Claus doesn't make you psychotic. You're just a little kid.
Right.
But Santa Claus is a fantasy and you think it's some, and it doesn't make sense. But we don't say that kids are psychotic because they still believe in Santa Claus.
Exactly. I think one of the other things that I really liked about the whole process that he has in diagnosis is that sometimes it does change.
Absolutely.
As a client grows or becomes more comfortable with you, there might be things that you didn't realize or things that they weren't comfortable disclosing. And then maybe it is a chance to make a change. And sometimes it's something that needs to be done and sometimes it isn't. But I think especially with a kid, which I think, and, you know, clearly in this situation, having the least harmful diagnosis that you can is the most important. But also being as accurate as you can be.
Because you don't have to slap a kid with a diagnosis to work with them on these symptoms.
Right.
I think that's where we get really stuck in what we call the medical model, which is in order to treat a medical issue, you have to have the specific diagnosis to know what you're working with. So you can't administer antibiotic B until you know what disease A is. And so I think that's why we get really stuck. Sometimes people can get really stuck in, well, what's my diagnosis in mental health? Like, once I figure out my diagnosis is, then we can fix me or I can fix this kid.
Right.
But that doesn't really matter as much because you can still help a kid.
No, not as much.
Without having like the specific diagnosis. It's more... we use the term holistic, but it's more easygoing than that. You don't need to have like A equals B in therapy for in mental health for things to progress in the right direction or to help people out. And so I really like that he doesn't just go, oh, this kid's schizophrenic. He needs to be on meds. I can't help this kid or we need to do this very specific thing. Instead, he gives it room because he knows the kid's safe-ish, like he knows that they have room to figure this out.
Exactly.
And in more real life, if he wasn't like a dead ghost, he'd probably work more with the mom.
Are there live ghosts, Brittany?
Well, you know what I mean. He probably would work with the mom, you know, talk to the mom like, hey, can you keep track of what you're noticing in the house?
Yeah.
Because you'd want to have eyes in the home, kind of like, are you seeing him interact with things that aren't there? Is he talking to himself? You'd want the mom to kind of be like you're in your eyes in the house and you probably really want the mom to know like this is what I'm have some concerns about this. I you know, don't worry, you know, don't let's not freak out, but like this is where we're going with it. Maybe we need to have some plans in place.
Right.
And so you'd be probably with a kid this young, do a lot of collaborating with the parent, just what we call psychoeducation, which is how it sounds, like giving him education about psychological issues. Just to kind of make sure that as you're feeling out the situation, that the kid's in a safe environment, that you don't have to go immediately on meds because you know the kid's being supervised, that they're not hurting themselves, as far as you know, hurting other people.
And I think that part of it seems as though, and correct me if I'm wrong, but whenever you're working with kids, that there's a bigger chance that you're going to have more people that you're going to talk to about the kid to get a diagnosis versus an adult. The only person you talk to is them.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Like sometimes you work with the school if that's appropriate. That's,
right.
Like you ask the teachers about what's going on if the problems aren't in school. Sometimes you'll do that. But a lot of times because you don't want to interrogate the kid. That's one part of it.
Exactly.
And two, because they're kids, they're not always the best reporters of what's going on.
Yeah.
Because they're not observing. With kids, you're in a unique situation where hopefully you have someone who's kind of observing the kid at all times. And that can be really helpful, that information.
When I was at the school that I worked at, it was like I had to talk to the teacher, I had to talk to the parents, and then I talked to the kid, like, and then I had to look at their file. Like, it was this whole thing of kind of getting an idea. But then I also tried to just help meet the kid where they were.
Yeah, and I thought it was really great that he, after going through all of this, that he still acknowledged the possibility that I don't know if I can help this kid, and he may need medication. Like, but he didn't make that the only option. He just went like, this might need to be part of the treatment plan here. I might need to adjust what I'm doing based on this new information. I thought that was really great because there's some people who might go like, oh, they're psychotic. Medication is the only option
here. They're too severe for me now.
Right. And he made that like as a, I may not be able to help this kid. He may need medication. He may need a hospitalization. I think he actually used the word acute hospitalization, right?
He said possible hospitalization like that, like when he was making his, like when he's in his talking to his dictaphone about it. But he, like I said, like he didn't like start freaking out and like make the kid aware of like, because you can have all those thoughts buzzing in your head as a therapist.
Oh, and
the kid doesn't need to see any of that on your face.
No.
No. I mean, you a lot have of times, that conversation
like, there's
with the mom.
There's times in session where I'm like, in my brain, my eyes are very wide. But in my face, they are not. They're chill. Yeah. But my head's like, oh, shit. And I'm, like, starting to already, like, plan and, like, think. And, like, I'm having a reaction because I'm surprised or whatever.
Right.
But the kid does not need to see that. And also, the kid knows, like, in this situation, because he took so long to tell him the secret.
Yeah.
He knows that it's fucking weird. And he knows that it's not normal.
He wouldn't be right. hiding
so you don't need
well, he tells himself freak throughout the whole movie.
You don't need to... Yeah. The kid already knows the gravity of the situation. Mm-hmm. You freaking out on him isn't, like, what he needed to hear to realize that he's not in reality. This kid knows he's experiencing something that's not normal.
Absolutely.
Yep. For sure knows. So we covered the diagnosis pretty well here. I mean, in the end, it turns out that I think this kid is dealing more with depression and...
Yeah.
I don't think...
But you gave him an adjustment disorder of seeing ghosts. Based on because, I mean, if you really think about it, this is a very fair. This is a very traumatizing situation for this kid to be in.
Oh, yeah, I think you'd have to do a rule out for trauma, post-traumatic stress.
Well, because he probably never feels, a little more in the beginning of the movie, before they kind of reframe the situation. I'm sure he never feels safe. Like, when he goes to pee in the middle of the night, he kind of stands in his hallway first because he doesn't even know if he wants to run to the bathroom.
Right.
Yeah. Then he's like, I'm going to chance it. And then he gets fucked with that scary mom ghost.
Right. Yeah.
So, like, this kid is in a constant state of fear and anxiety, almost probably akin to a kid who's, like, in a war zone. Like, never knows when he's going to be attacked or in a highly abusive situation of any kind.
Yeah.
Like, never feels comfortable, never feels safe. He creates that little protective fort with all the religious icons, bless his heart. And that gets penetrated by a ghost.
Yeah.
Like,
there's nowhere that he can
there's
be safe.
No way in that situation that he, I mean, it's that he might get better because his environment is so, like, I can't imagine what it would be like. Like, that's, I can get why that Vincent Gray character ended up the way he did, because that's got to be a terrifying, if we're going to believe this is the truth, like, that's a terrifying way to live.
It's a terrifying experience to have
and
to
so
be
out of control.
Yeah.
You can't get away from it. And I think it is a really good allegory for a kid maybe in an abusive environment where you never know what's going to happen, if you're safe, if you're going to get hurt, if you can go in this room, if you can say this thing. You know, you're, and then also, it's a good allegory for true psychosis in that he's probably not doing well in school because he's always distracted. Because that's a lot of
Absolutely.
Times, even when you have someone who's like right. a higher functioning person with psychotic factors or like experiences, it's so like if you're hearing someone talking in your ear all the goddamn time, like how do you get good grades? How do you function in society? Like, how that would make you irritable, can you imagine? And that
I
would
mean,
make
I
you
remember,
and then also like you're hearing secrets as well,
right? There's a great training to simulate that, to, created by a psychologist who has been living with schizophrenia. It's called Hearing Voices, and there's many places nationwide to do that. So if you've ever been kind of curious about what that might be like, they simulated what having schizophrenia is like and put you through daily tasks so you can see and kind of experience that, and it is a mind-opening experience.
I mean, I think that part of, I just remember asking people that I worked with before, like, trying to find things that they like to do, and being like, oh, do you read? And no, he doesn't fucking read, because he hears voices all the time. So he can't concentrate long enough in order to absorb a story because of the voices that he hears all the time. So it was kind of like realizing that, and how, what a big impact that has, and how just feeling scared and frustrated and angry. That there's nothing that you can do to make them go away or to change them. And that's, I mean, I can't imagine what that would be like.
And also the imagery to be so fucking scary that he's seeing.
Well, yeah, I mean, like seeing a kid with a bullet hole
or
in his head.
Or like those three
people
hanging. Yeah, hanging at his school. Like, it's like he never knows when he's going to get hit in the face with a scary. It's like living inside of a horror movie.
I mean, there's a reason why I hadn't seen this movie.
Yeah.
And that is it.
But I mean, I guess this can slide
wait till we have you watch It.
Oh, girl.
You better keep it together. I don't think that's going to happen.
But I mean...
you better lock it up.
It is interesting. I mean, I had this thought. I wrote this down in my notebook. Like, would antipsychotics medication work with someone who genuinely sees ghosts? Because I wonder if, like, what part of your brain... I mean, this is me just going on a real tangent.
Yeah,
but,
girl.
Like, what part of your brain would light up if it's similar to having hallucinations? Like, it would be, I'm assuming, part of his brain's different than ours. And could you medicate that to quiet the noise down?
I
don't think there's an answer to that.
I don't
question.
Think there's an answer to that, Brittany.
I really want to like give you one though, but there really definitely
but if it's coming through the visual processing part of the brain because he's actually seeing it.
Yeah.
Like, are we assuming there's a different structure in his brain because he's perceiving things that normal people can't?
I would
can't.
Love for, like, this a behavioral neuroscientist to, like, tackle.
To come in here and be
email
like,
email us, brah. Tell yes. me all about it.
Yes.
Where? What part of your brain sees ghosts?
Well, then it's a philosophical question, too. Like, yeah, so if you know the answer to this, please, by all means, email us. I would love to know. But like, okay, is your ocular nerve, like, more advanced to us where you're perceiving things that we can't normally see? Like, is it, like, an issue of can you see a spectrum of light that normal people can't see? Okay. Or
are you are you radiating on a different frequency, bro?
Right. Like, this could get...
So, like, having a sixth sense is what you guys are talking about?
Or an enhanced sense. So whether
I
or not,
held it in
so what?
For like 10 seconds.
What we've done now?
Well, now
thank
we
you,
can
Hannah,
slide into the realism
is
of
deciding
genuine...
is this kid is belongs at Xavier School for the Gifted or not.
Oh, excellent! But I would say so. Curtailing this
well
into
done,
actual clients with genuine psychosis, they do things in this movie that I think are genuinely good things that we've done with clients. We kind of talked about in the beginning.
Yeah,
but one of it is not. Don't get he doesn't get bogged down into what we call reality testing with this kid, where you are like, but it's, I don't, he does it a little bit when he's like, do you really see him over there? Because I don't see them over there
in the school. Yeah.
But he doesn't say it like, I don't see anything, dude. He says it more like he's just kind, I think he's like assessing the situation in that moment.
Yeah.
Like, are you really seeing something there? And also he's kind of testing it. Like, to see if I tell the kid I can't see it, is he going to hold to that truth? Because then you're also seeing how genuine it is for the client.
Absolutely.
Like, if I challenge it, are they going to keep insisting that they see something? Because if it was just, like, a fantasy that the kid's having, maybe they'll back down in that moment.
Yeah.
But if it's something really... And also, he's really good at reading him, like, you're genuinely scared. And I can tell that you're shaking.
Yeah.
And you're cold and all that stuff. But... but like, I think sometimes people get stuck in the trying to prove to the person who's having hallucinations that they're not experiencing reality.
Yeah.
And wanting to like prove to them like, well, you hear something upstairs, we'll go upstairs and then we'll see there's nobody there. All in my experience, when I've been around people who are genuinely psychotic, that doesn't go very well.
No,
when it also
it's patronizing, it's condescending.
It undermines,
especially if you're with an adult.
It undermines a therapeutic relationship 100%. If you don't believe me,
how can you help me?
Well, yeah. Also, if you're dealing with someone who's not dealing in reality, they can. It's like believing in conspiracies. You're going to have another reason why the thing that you're saying isn't true. Well, they must have moved. Well, they know what they're doing.
Exactly.
They're out to get me, so they would be savvy. They probably have a backup door that they go out of. Like, there's always
or
a
maybe you're working for them.
Or I only hear them when you're not here. Or...
Because they must know when you visit.
Exactly.
And so...
It's an impossible...
Yeah.
You're never
going to talk someone out of having hallucinations.
No, until they're ready to accept that they are not, in fact, real stimuli, that it is internal-based stimuli that's not... actually happening and ready to accept and deal with that, you can't force that moment. And that often comes with medication help where they can get toned down or dealt with, going like, look, see, like when you're medicated, those aren't the same. And we can talk about how, you know, you can maybe cope with those better or challenge them. And depending on what state they're at, you're either talking about how to rationalize yourself out of it or minimize the impact. A lot of people hear voices. You'll see them with headphones in all the time because they'll be listening to music to like tone
out the
voices with something pleasant because the brain can only handle so much stimuli at once. And
which I think is also part of why people who suffer from schizophrenia self-medicate.
Mm-hmm. They're trying to dull
different
it.
Things. They're trying to dull
absolutely.
What they're experiencing because it's such an intense. Mm-hmm. Experience to hear voices or to see things that aren't there or to smell things that aren't happening or mm-hmm. whatever the case may be.
And I think what he does beautifully as well is he asks Cole very open-ended questions about, we kind of talked about the ghost, like, what do you think they want from you? And you can ask those kind of questions and it doesn't mean that you're telling the client that what they're experiencing is real. Like, I think that also the concern is that I just go with it, that I'm confirming for the client that someone is out to get them or da 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 da, and that I'm like hurting them because I'm becoming part of like the fantasy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be helpful to probe into it and try to figure out, what's, if you're treating it like it's real and this is the problem that they're experiencing that is real for them, well, let's see if we can find a way to fix it within the delusion.
Yeah.
Like, if you feel like in that situation, specifically with Cole, if you feel like these people are coming at you, mm-hmm. well, then what do you think they want? And is that something that you can change? You might not be able to change the fact that you're experiencing these hallucinations, but can you change your role in the hallucinations? Like, can you make yourself more powerful in the hallucinations yeah. or the delusion? Can you make it so that you can tell them to go away? Can we make a magic word up that when you say that magic word, they disappear? Like, you can kind of play within the fantasy to make them feel more powerful. And if that helps them feel better, and if it takes away some of the symptoms or the issues, that's okay. The
anxiety.
Because you don't have to go at it straight from, I have to prove to this person that what they're experiencing is not real.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can help them feel better by kind of rolling with the delusion.
You can. You don't, and talking about movies with this, I keep thinking of the opening scene to Patch Adams, where you see Robin Williams, like, this guy.
I don't like that movie.
You don't like that movie?
I haven't watched it in 1,000 years.
It starts out with he's in a mental ward with a client. I can't remember if he's there too. I think he's doing a psych rotation. But there's a guy who sees a squirrel, and the squirrel's harassing him, and then he like helps him like invent this invisible bazooka, and they eliminate the squirrel, and he just like rolls with him within the hallucination, and then builds on it to the point where the guy can deal with it. And you're like, oh, look, squirrel's gone.
Well, because in that situation, what's that hurting? Nobody. And that's what you have to be mindful
right.
of. Exactly. Like, if there's no harm, no foul, then why not try this and see
and
what happens?
And it's that idea that we work with what the client, we meet the client where they are and work on the things that they want to work on, or that will give them the most comfort.
And with a kick kind, especially in the situation, you can do a lot of play and a lot of imagination and a lot of fantasy in a positive way. Yeah. Well, let's pretend that you're a superhero. And what could a superhero do? And let's say these things that you're experiencing are supervillains. Now, what could you do to make them go away? Or like fucking Harry Potter, like be like, okay, you're a wizard. What's a spell that you could do? Like, because let's say this is all in his head. Let's say it's all in Cole's head. What he does that's really great is he makes it so that Cole has a problem to solve within. He makes Cole create a problem that he can then solve. And then once that problem is solved, it resolves some of the anxiety about it. It doesn't make the hallucinations go away.
Exactly.
It doesn't make the psychosis go away, but it makes him feel like there's a resolution to it.
Right.
There's a problem that he has control over, and that it also we call it reframe in therapy, but redefines what these hallucinations are for him. If they are hallucinations, like these are friendly ghosts, they're not mean ghosts anymore.
Right.
Right.
Because they just need something from me. It's kind of like I do this on a lesser level about like anxiety and depression, which isn't psychosis, but you can say, can you think of your anxiety as a monster that lives inside of your head? And when that comes to attack you by telling you things that are mean or making you stressed out, pretend that you are putting that anxiety in a box, kind of like you said, Ben, and like throwing it away. Or saying a magic phrase at it, or a mantra. And that's, you wouldn't say that person's psychotic for doing this kind of thing. You know what I mean? They're just learning how to redefine this experience in a way that makes them feel like they have control.
Right. Absolutely. Indeed. And it gives that sense of control, leads to a sense of resolution, which can lead to more functional behavior, which we see with Cole, and they do a great job of representing it visually. I think him having a sword is kind of like the way that M. Night Shyamalan like was able to like look, this kid drew his sword from the stone, and now he's able to take on the mantle of a different role in the story, whereas before he was a victim and now he's the hero.
Well, and also too, like, what would happen if you talked to your hallucinations? What would happen if you talked to these ghosts? Which he never did before. He just ran from them.
Right.
Right.
And so if you confront, but like not as aggressive as that sounds, but if you were to talk to these things that are talking to you, what do you think they would say? And maybe the person you work with has never even thought of that because they just run from it because it scares them. It's a way for them to, if it's possible, because sometimes it's not possible,
sometimes
to mold the situation a little bit for them in their head.
It's just so different for every different person that we work with, right? And what they're experiencing, how much they're able to be aware of and have insight into, and how much is just helping them get through the 20 minutes that they're sitting with you. I mean, getting through riding on the bus, and how that can be really stressful, and how helping them being able to just be okay with riding on the bus for 25 minutes. Like, it was such a different experience of working with people in that way and seeing how much it affects every part of their life.
Well, because with Cole, a big defining factor of why he got better in the movie, or dealt with his symptoms better, if we're going to call him that, is that he was open to Bruce Willis's feedback, and he was willing to try what he was telling them. Because in some cases I've worked with people that are very stuck in their psychosis or hallucinations, you can't talk to them about it. It's never going to be any different. And I feel like in my experience, and I know this is very individual, that's usually with cases where the person's very, very ill and they usually have to be on medication when they're that stuck in it. Like, it's pretty hardcore. And they have to have insight because they have to be able to say, this is something happening to me that's separate from me and I can do something about it. Because they have to be able to, like, make that separation of this is a problem outside of myself. Whereas I think sometimes when people are very ill, it's so surrounding them and it's so inside of them that they can't separate enough from it to feel like they have any autonomy to do anything about it. It's just, it's overwhelming. Absolutely. And so they have to be able to have enough insight to recognize that they can change the story a little bit, or that they can do something about it at all.
Yeah, which I think we saw a lot with the adults that we worked with when we worked together, that someone who had been struggling with a severe diagnosis for a really long time and also has had a lot of reinforcement of not being believed and being in situations where then they're more traumatized by that situation. And so having people who, sometimes there's people who won't be able to have any awareness or insight into that, and that's okay. And again, and then we just help them manage their anxiety and manage the other parts that help them live their life.
Well, a lot of it also too is the factors around, like, your environment. Like, Cole is a child, so he's being taken care of to a certain extent. He has a mom who is very calm and very loving and supports him and believes him for the most part. And that's a big, that means everything in terms of him feeling together enough to do something.
Yeah.
And he feels very believed, I think. And it's because his mom and Bruce don't try to argue with him and they don't get in his face and they don't go, what's wrong with you? Or why are you acting like this? Or why can't you be different?
Yeah.
They create a very safe, secure, loving perimeter around him that makes it easier to take chances and to take risks with your mental health symptoms. Because trying to do something different, like confronting your symptoms, that's very scary and it takes a lot of courage.
Oh yeah.
Huge. Especially if you think it's really happening to you. That's fucking terrifying.
It's scary. I mean, and the things that, you know, Cole sees are not necessarily different than what we might hear some of our clients who've been dealing with psychotic diagnosis experience, like hearing noises, seeing things that are scary, feeling like people are out to get you. These things are common and people have them. And imagine times when you've felt that maybe somebody was following you that wasn't, but you started to get that fear in you. Like, imagine feeling that all the time. Or you hear a sound
in your house and you're like, is someone downstairs?
Right.
Like, is there an intruder?
But that's there all the time.
And there's never any way to, when there's never any way to escape it, that's part of what causes the struggle with insight and awareness, because it feels it's real.
And sometimes, where medication comes into play is that it can make it a little less intense.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be like zombied out on medicine. Sometimes you just need to make it a little quieter, so then you can use coping skills to help yourself deal with the
slump. And that's exactly the way I've heard people who have had, people that I worked with who had schizophrenia, is that sometimes the medication that they're on just kind of dims the voices. They're just not as loud,
right?
Which means they're able to focus more and do things that they like, or actually learn coping skills, because now they have the space in their mind to be able to absorb something else besides just hearing voices.
Right. And something to say about hearing voices, I had a client who completely altered my perception on it at one point in time. Is this client, you know, cued me and they're like, you know what, my voices are nice to me.
Sometimes they're their friends and they miss them when they're gone.
Yeah. So, like, just because someone has them doesn't mean they're necessarily distressed by them. Like, does it mean that there's something going on that needs treatment? I mean, that there can be a different philosophical argument there. It depends on how they're interacting with them or what impact that's having on their life. But one of the key defining characteristics of any mental disorder is that it is causing disruption in someone's life.
Yeah, like, if you're functioning and you're not hurting anybody and you like it, then keep on keeping on. Yeah. Because sometimes in session, I'll tell a person, well, is it bothering you? And if they say no, then I'm like, all right, do whatever you want. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if it's not hurting anybody, it's not bothering your life. Yeah. Then, because also people aren't motivated to change or to do anything differently unless it's distressing them and they're very uncomfortable. All change comes from a place of discomfort.
Right.
And if they're not uncomfortable and it's whatever, then I just help clients, okay, I'm not going to try harder than you are.
Yeah.
Just because looking from the outside in, I think that it's not the healthiest way to be. But if it's, if you're fine, then fuck it. I mean, not like that, but like, but what,
that,
what's,
but it's, but that part of meeting, life. Of meeting them where they are, yeah, and working on what they want to work on. Someone who comes in and they have a diagnosis of having schizophrenia, but they have learned skills over time, and really they're coming in because they're anxious about getting a job, feeling, yeah, okay to get a job. I mean, like, you would, we just never know. It just depends on and how important and how much that can really change the story. If I see that diagnosis on the intake form, and then all of a sudden, I'm just like, what are the voices like? What is that like? How are you doing? And start just driving my own fucking agenda. What are the chances that person's going to come back? Pretty fucking slim.
Slim.
But also, you're making them feel like they're a crazy person.
Yeah.
With those kind of questions.
Right.
Yeah. Clearly.
So if we got Cole as a client, what would we want to do for treatment?
I mean, I'm going to be real. I don't know what else I would do for him. I think how it's done in this movie is fantastic. Because I think the way that Bruce Willis talks to him about the acts, has asked all those open-ended questions.
Sure.
Fabulous.
Absolutely.
Lets the kid define the whole situation.
Right.
Awesome. Doesn't really put stupid rules around the situation.
Nope.
Great. And the just reframing the, his hallucinate, his story, to be more positive and to make him feel more powerful within it is awesome. Like, you see this kid's, what they do brilliantly in this movie too is this kid's, we say affect, but the way his facial expressions and his emotional state, the way he becomes more open and more smiley as the movie goes on is so good
and so realistic. And he becomes, what I love about it is he becomes more adaptive. They kind of use the play to have, like, it has visual meaning to it, and but it also has a social component of it, of you're seeing this kid now go from the point where, like, he has gone from, like, the bullied kid who plays, like, the bullshit roles and gets, you know, put in the background and kind of ignored unless something wrong happens, to being the focal point of attention because he's becoming more integrated into the social structure of the school, with both interacting positively with the teacher who he had kind of a crisis moment with, and also with other kids, the comfortable with the spotlight being on him, with all the teachers looking at him, with the other kids looking positively towards him. And I loved the way that they made the bully kid who was all full of himself and like, well, I was in this commercial, all of a sudden get switched to like, and now you're the bullshit role.
I mean, I don't know how realistic that would be in real life. I think that was just kind of like the story of the movie, like a hero narrative.
Sure.
But that was very satisfying. And also I would say, with working with this kid, I don't think I could have asked more of the mom either. I think she does such a stellar, stellar, beautiful, beautiful job of always staying very calm with him. She does not make her problems his problem. She's obviously a very stressed single mom. I think, and I even think there's a lot of what I would describe as like single parent anxiety, where,
oh, absolutely.
Because when you're in a lot of situations, which isn't necessarily like a judgment, I'm not saying this in a judgmental way. When there's one kid and one parent, there's going to be a certain amount of what we call enmeshment, which is being a little too involved with each other.
Yeah.
Because you are taking care of each other in a very one-to-one basis.
Right. It's unavoidable.
And so, but I think she does a really good job of making sure he's a child. Like, she does, like, when they're in the shopping cart and she, like, makes Mac like he's flying. Like, she very much, I think, makes sure he still feels like a kid, like, brings some little moments of childlike joy.
Yeah.
And she does such a beautiful job of validating him in, like, what we call active listening. Like, when he's in these moments where he's clearly distressed, even when she's clearly distressed and he says, how are you doing? Or, like, what are you thinking about me, mama? The way that she does that look at my face thing is so good. Because what she's doing, and this is stuff that I encourage in parents I work with, which is, don't get caught up in the moment. Pay attention to what are the feelings behind the behavior.
Absolutely.
And validate, just be there present for the kid. Like, and also, it's good to have him look at the face, like I said, because she's being very, like, she wants to make sure in those moments that he is really looking at her and that he knows that she is there with him.
Yeah.
And she means it. and that she's here and she's listening and she's with him and she doesn't judge him and that she loves him. She does a lot of the unconditional positive regard stuff, because even when she's pissed at him, when she's about the brooch or the butterfly pin, her mom's pin.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Dependent.
And she scolds him and she sends him to his room. And that wasn't inappropriate because he was lying in her mind. And so she's like, go to your room.
Yeah.
And he comes and he's clearly so wound up. She doesn't hold a grudge against him. She sees that he's upset and she's with him.
Right.
And I think
she doesn't say, go to your room. I told you to go to your room.
No, yeah. She hugs him. He clearly needs.
And that's
clearly he's not manipulating. He's
And
he's
so
having a hard time.
That's something that I try to encourage a lot when I work with parents and kids is stay with, if the kid's having a very clear emotional reaction, like be in that moment with them and make sure that they're feeling heard and validated. And don't get caught up in like the bullshit, I guess. I don't know how the way to put it, but like just be and make sure the kid understands that you still love them and that you're still here for them no matter what's happening around the situation. You can still, like, she still has expectations of him. She still scolds him about stuff. You know, he's very clearly like a kid in this situation. But she, when she can see that he's struggling, she kind of puts the brakes on that and she tries to help him.
Yeah. And she also, even though he's struggling, still makes extra efforts to get the kid socialized and to try to get him involved in the social structure and, you know, not let him isolate and be a freak, and she doesn't ever let him feel like a freak. At least she never tolerates that. She does a lot of trying to reframe and trying to build up his esteem and trying to build up his self-confidence, even though he's having a hard time.
And I think
she acknowledges that, and she still tries to keep him moving in a forward direction, even though he's having a hard time.
And she uses gruffness in a way that I like sometimes when she's like, look at me. You're not a freak. I do not think you're a freak. And she's very, like, hard. But in very forceful, good way where she's like, this is the truth.
Yeah.
You know, do not, you know. And I think that, because it doesn't always have to be, oh, baby, da-da-da-da-da. Like, sometimes what a kid needs is for you to, like, be coming at them with a lot of force. In a positive way, like, this is what I believe. And I'm not saying
and I'm not going to tolerate an experience where that is true for you.
Mm-hmm.
In that same way.
It kind of like standing up for him.
Yeah.
In a way. So, I mean, I don't really have anything additionally. I mean, I think if I was working with a kid who saw ghosts, I mean, staying present, I guess, would be like, I think you really have to, because it's such a out there idea that I have no, I guess it, a lot of it would be when I work with a kid who's having a situation that I don't know anything about, is you try to do, or a client in general, you try to do a lot of, tell me about this. Help me understand what you're going through. What's that like for you? You ask a lot of curious questions to kind of understand what's going on. Because you don't want to make any assumptions and you don't want to lead the kid with ideas and put a story in their head. Especially if you think it might be something they're making up. Like, you really want to be letting them tell the story to you and let them educate
using their
you. Because then they feel like they're important and that they're an expert and they're and you guys are... you're respecting what they're saying about what they're talking about. Because I don't know what it's like to see ghosts, but also, like, I don't know what it's like to have hallucinations either.
Yeah.
So don't make assumptions and make them, because that can also be very discouraging if you just make a lot of assumptions, put a lot of words in their mouth that can cause, especially kids who feel like they're being talked to a lot and not talked with or talked at,
mm-hmm.
to make them feel like you respect their expertise about their experience.
Right. And something else I think that, I mean, we talked about off mic, but I think I want to make sure that we get in there, is that you don't know what this kid's religion is. You don't know what their culture is. There are religions and cultures around the world who believe strongly in ghosts and
I was raised Catholic.
And spirits. And
they believe
don't
in exorcisms and demons.
Right. And there's other religions and beliefs and systems in the world that view spirits favorably.
Yeah.
Or and like shamanistic religions.
Sure.
Like shamanistic cultures.
And then there could be reasons why your ancestors may be visiting you, and there might be trying to give you a message, and that message might be reinforced by your family and how that's spun. Like, if you try to, in the therapeutic setting, like, oh, that's not real, that's pathological, like, we need to talk about that, we need to address that and get that. If you haven't tried to explore the culture of the family with the child, depending on age, or the parent, Which I guess is my one like change on this movie, is that I would want to see actual interaction between the provider and the parent.
Yeah.
Which, you know, he's a ghost, so that can happen. But
the fucking problem.
But they
man.
Do make he's you a think dead ghost they in this are movie, talking Brittany. To each other. We just don't see them.
Right.
Because the movie does try to trick you into thinking that they are interacting.
Yeah.
Like he's at the hospital with the mom.
Right.
He's talking to her before the kid comes in that one time. Yeah. Or you think he is.
Right.
But we just don't get an example of what that would look like between Toni Collette and Bruce Willis.
Right. Right. And you don't see a lot of that. But I think I would want to see the culture of the family of origin explored and what the belief system in the home is before I made any judgments about whether I think the kid is psychotic or what is going on here. Because that may just be the way that they interpret the world, and you want to make sure you're being sensitive to that and that you're not assuming that just because this country is predominantly monotheistic, that's the only possible option or way of life that other people have.
Well, and also, how widely embraced mainstream-wise is the Long Island medium or John Edwards? Like, there's a lot of mainstream America who has validated the idea of, like, literally talking to ghosts.
I had a colleague who did in-home family therapy, and she definitely had this experience with the culture of the family. And that there was a chance that the child might not even have had any kind of symptoms. It really was just following through with the stories and legends that he'd been told by his family based on the religion that they were. So, I mean, I think that's a really good point, Ben, that we have to make sure, especially in a situation like this, especially with the age of a child and trying to make sure that we're taking into account everything and not just basing it on, you know, one thing, which I think we've talked a lot about already about the diagnosis and how important it is. I think when it comes to marriage and family therapy, that I honestly didn't really see a whole lot, mostly because I think it's such a tricky story. It would be hard to do.
Well, because a lot of it that is like pathological that is real.
In the story of so the it's movie. Really so it's really hard for me to imagine. Because here's the thing: him and his mom have a really good relationship.
Yeah,
and him and his therapist have a really good relationship.
Right.
So in that vein, I don't know that there would need to be any kind of, you know, co-therapy.
Dealing with the mom after hearing the story that he told her, like the mom coping with a child who is saying these things and doing
and helping her find coping skills and things that can help her understand, or ways that she can help her child understand what's going on. And but again, that would be psychoeducation that might be already be given by, you know, in this case, Bruce Willis. So I don't know. I think it would probably depend on if there's more family members, and I think that family therapy would be appropriate. But it seems as though things are going pretty well with this family. And I don't know that they would seek out a family therapist.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
In this case, I think that their relationship is good. I think she would be more wanting to make sure that her kid is okay. So sounds like we kind of generally feel that the relationship between Bruce and Cole in this movie was represented accurately for the most part. It was done respectfully of the profession. It was done in a way that holistically represented what it might look like to go through a whole therapeutic process and then face a healthy discharge.
My only critique of like mainstream people watching this movie is expecting their kid's therapist to be so involved in the kid, like going to the hospital and going to the school play. Like, that's not a realistic expectation of a child therapist. No. But that's my only real critique. And also, it's because he was a ghost, and so he couldn't.
You're right.
Was it a live ghost or a dead ghost?
A dead ghost.
Okay.
I checked his pulse. Dead ghost.
I definitely did like this movie, though, and I'm glad that I had a chance to watch it. And I think that, and it wasn't as scary as I thought. But I think it was a really. I agree with you guys. I think it did a really good job in this movie, and it was really nice for, you know, once maybe to see a positive just showing how well they show rapport and how well the relationship is.
Yeah, I don't think I've watched this movie. I think I went on like my first date to see this movie. I think this is what that happened. Like first like high school or like late junior high when it's like starts to actually be a date. But I don't think I've seen it since then, and it was really different. It was a much more emotional movie than I remember. I
cry every time I watch this movie.
I remember being like a horror movie. That last scene had like my face leaking a little bit. Like, what the like, what is going on here? And like, I remember like it being so scary and like being all the jump scares getting me. Like,
Misha Barton when she's throwing up in that tent, dude.
Oh yeah,
that really gets me every time I watch it.
Yeah,
scared the shit out.
Like this time I wasn't. I mean, I also was expecting all of them now, but like. I didn't react to any of them, but I found like a completely different meaning and now have seen like most of M. Night Shyamalan's movies, like being able to pick up on the themes of like, you know, like finding what makes you special and using that to solve a bigger problem to help yourself and the world. And that seems to be like a theme in his movies that he explores, like the personal heroism and like overcoming challenges, using your problems to solve problems and like reframe your narrative is something that I took from it that I really liked. And I like this movie more now than I did before because of the way it represented my profession positively, but also in showing how you can find that personal power and completely flip your script and change your narrative, change the way you interpret things, which can improve your life. So I thought it was great.
I mean, it does the thing that I love when anything does this, which is treats children's feelings very seriously. This kid is going through it, like, and I think that's why, like, the end scene makes me cry.
Yeah.
And just why my heart is, like, in my throat the whole movie whenever, like, Haley Joel Osment's on the screen, is he does a good job of respecting the gravitas of this kid's experience and how troubling it is and how rooted in, I don't know, just deep, deep, deep feelings and taking it seriously. Like, part of what's so beautiful about Bruce Willis's approach to this kid and hopefully all child therapists is that he treats this kid with so much respect, that this is his story, that these are his feelings. Yes. I believe that they all are true for him. He's feeling them deeply and I'm not going to tell him otherwise. And I think a lot of times, unfortunately with children, there's a lot of like writing them off or like disbelieving them or kind of laughing off what they're feeling or thinking. And I think this movie does such a good job of also just like that actor, Haley Joel Osment, of conveying like the deep loneliness and emotional struggle and like staying with it and not making little of it. Even when he says he sees ghosts, like he doesn't laugh at him and his mom doesn't laugh at him or him off or tell him he's fucking bullshitting. Like it's such a good job of like the weight of all of it and treating it very beautifully. And I think now watching it as a therapist, I have so much respect, like Ben said, about how Bruce Willis conducts himself in the movie's therapist. But also, I think even more, like, how beautifully his mom does it. Because his mom isn't a therapist. Like, I have a lot more expectation of Bruce Willis's character.
Yeah.
But his mom could not have handled it better. Especially as a single mom, a lot, being really frustrated, having a kid where she does not understand what the fuck is going on with this kid.
Absolutely.
And she's never making it about him. I hope she's taking care of herself. Probably not.
Yeah.
No, not but, working two jobs, she's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, no but she doesn't make it ever about
herself. But she's still able to
herself.
Be present. Yeah,
like, she's never like, you're driving me nuts. Yeah. Or I need you to be good today because I'm having a hard day. Like, she is so good about that. And I just think, and one little thing I wrote, like I read in the trivia of this movie. Well, I don't know if it's so much trivia, but he talks about how the reason why he never feels cold when he's with Bruce Willis, like never has like the telltale signs of being around a ghost, which is like the breath, is that the temperature only goes down when they're upset. And so Bruce is never upset with him. So it never gets cold when he's with Bruce. And isn't that like, make your little heart go?
Yeah.
When he said the movie, I was like, oh, that's why it's never go. Like, this movie, for being a scary movie, I don't think scary movies get a lot of credit sometimes for being emotional. So I'm glad this movie got the respect it deserves. Like, it's on the AFI Top 100 list. Haley Joel Osment was nominated for an Oscar. And because it's a really good story.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And also, like, doing this podcast has been very interesting now watching these movies as a therapist about which movies get it more right. It's usually not the ones you're expecting.
No, it really isn't. That's true. Totally
like, this
agree.
Movie nails it.
What a different setting it is to watch movies from this point of view, just as a therapist.
So, I mean, fair to say, final thoughts, I loved it. I love this movie.
Yeah, it's good.
I definitely really enjoyed it, much more than I thought, and from a different perspective, and yeah, I really liked it.
Yeah.
So find us at Facebook, find us on Instagram, Popcorn Psychology, find us on Twitter at popcorn_psych.
Psych, yeah.
popcornpsychology@gmail.com is where you can always hit us up with recommendations, opinions, critiques, whatever. So we will see you in 2 weeks.